Welcome to the Eat Right Nutrition Podcast, where we partner with experts in the health, wellness, and nutrition field to deliver you an excellent variety of content based on real science, real facts, and real food. I'm your host, Daron.
And I'm Nicole.
And today we're talking overrated, underrated nutrition style. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode number 136 of the Eat Right Nutrition Podcast, where today we cover overrated, underrated nutrition style, and we're going to talk about, I guess, Nicole, this is a tough one for me. What are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about a lot of little different things.
Ladies and gentlemen, big different things, I guess. Welcome to the Lot of Little Different Things podcast. We're going to talk about things that I think are touted to have benefit that may be overrated, and things that I think people underuse or don't use at, or don't even know about that are underrated nutrition strategies. So I guess that is kind of the synopsis of what's going to happen in this episode today. And we're going to have Nicole call them out, and I'm going to give my feedback on whether or not I think it's overrated or underrated. Nicole's also going to give her feedback. I'm sure there are some things that she may think differently on, so we will tackle them one at a time.
Brilliant. Go.
Well, you go.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Number one, fasted cardio.
Fasted cardio. Early studies on fasted cardio showed that it increased fat oxidation while you were doing cardio, which seems like awesome. That's great. You're burning more fat, or you're breaking down more fat and burning more fat while you're doing cardio in that cardio bout. But later studies found that there's a compensatory mechanism where, because you've oxidized more fat in the morning when you did that fasted cardio — now I'm assuming it's the morning because otherwise you're probably fasting all day — there's a compensatory mechanism that causes you to increase carb utilization later in the day and decrease fat oxidation later in the day, which means that you're kind of balancing out that whole process. And overall, when we look at studies on, for example, there's a study published by, I'm pretty sure it was published by Dr. Brad Schoenfeld, that showed weight loss between groups doing fasted cardio versus not fasting cardio isocalorically. They're eating the same amount of calories, and we found no difference in change of weight or decrease in body fat or body composition. So for those reasons, I'm going to go ahead and say that fasted cardio is overrated, and it's not going to produce a better outcome than doing, I guess, fed state cardio.
Well, I would agree. I do think it's overrated as well. I mean, a lot of people jump on the bandwagon thinking that it's going to give you like that extra something to burn more. I really do think it depends on the person, like not in terms of whether it works or not.
You can do whatever you want, right? You can, if you choose to do fasted cardio, I guess, Nicole, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I get all like tongue tied about this one, because I feel like if you mentally feel better not eating, or even physically, like if you get a stomach ache, if you eat a big meal before you do cardio, then go ahead and do it fasted. Someone like me, I have to have something to eat. I can't do fasted cardio. Not because I think there's a difference in benefit, but I just like to have something to eat before I do cardio. I feel better. So this one, I think, is really just depends on the person. If you love to get up and not have anything to eat into your cardio and get it over with, or you're someone that needs a small snack or even a big meal before you do your cardio, I don't think it makes a big difference at all. And clearly in the research, it doesn't either.
From a fat loss standpoint, it doesn't. I would say that potentially from a performance standpoint, like I'm not going to go and not eat something before I'm lifting, because then glycogen storage and energy and just the ability to perform at your best, I think, is more optimal when you've eaten. You're more hydrated later in the day when you're eating, right? And research kind of supports that. Like if you, a couple of things here, right? So if you train later on in the day, your body temperature, your core temperature is elevated, which allows you to train more efficiently, which can cause you to build more muscle more efficiently. And your glycogen storage is full, like I mentioned, and you're more fed. You have more energy available. Now, the kind of counter to that, that Nicole's going to tell me is, well, what if you work out in like early in the morning and you can't have a big meal before you're out the door because, you know, you're in a rush, you have to go to work. I already kind of know Nicole's rebuttals here. Then the answer to that is then don't eat something if you just absolutely can't. Obviously, adherence to your program is going to be the most important thing, but I'm just speaking from a place of what's going to be more optimal. And that is eating before, especially your resistance training. You may be able to get past, like, if you're doing cardio. And then also, I would argue it depends on the type of cardio that you're doing. Because if you're a long distance endurance runner, or if, for example, I'm training for the 100-mile bike ride, I need to be fed before, like, those long days. I need to make sure that I'm having adequate carbohydrates to fuel those bike rides. And and I have a pretty substantial meal prior to that. So in those cases, I would say from a performance standpoint, I think it's important to eat something beforehand. But from a purely fat loss standpoint, in terms of whether or not to do fasted cardio, it's way overrated. I've seen bodybuilders and competitive athletes
Go crazy.
Bikini girls and all of the whole bodybuilding community is kind of split down the middle, where some of them are like, and even some coaches in bodybuilding are like, you have to do fasted cardio every single morning. And it's the other half of the camp is like, I eat something before I do it.
Yeah. Again, the split down the middle, I think, is just depends on the person and what you feel. Like, I really think in situations like this, listening to your body is the most important part.
Thanks, Captain Obvious.
Well, nobody needs to, you know, if you're going to go get steps in, I'm not like feeding before I get my steps
in. But that's different. That's not, we're not talking performance at that point.
Right.
All right, Nicole, let's get the next one in.
All right. Bulletproof coffee is number 2.
Bulletproof coffee. So bulletproof coffee is coffee with grass-fed butter and MCT oil mixed in together. And this was kind of started with the whole keto movement. And it really started with Dave Asprey and his bulletproof diet. And so he created bulletproof coffee, right? Which is, I kind of think of as just butter in my coffee, which to me is kind of nonsense. So it's touted by keto advocates to boost mental focus, decrease hunger, and maintain steady energy throughout the day. I'm going to just say straight up, overrated. And I looked because I was curious. I was like, is there actually research behind this? And there were a couple of studies recently done in 2021. There was a study done and the studies show no evidence that bulletproof coffee boosts cognitive function. There's a randomized controlled trial comparing regular coffee to decaf to a placebo and bulletproof coffee, which is grass-fed butter and MCT oil. And there was no change in cognitive function. Now, kind of the caveat a little bit, the way I'd like to see the study done is maybe a little bit differently, because this study was done using, it put butter in all of the coffees. And the reason why is because participants had to not know that what they were drinking. So for example, if you put butter and MCT oil and you make bulletproof coffee, and then you just have somebody drink regular black coffee, they're going to know the difference because of the taste. So that's why researchers said, well, bulletproof coffee is technically grass-fed butter and MCT oil together. So let's just put butter in the other ones. And the other piece, now I would have liked to see that done differently, but either way, actually none of them showed that there was any difference in cognition on multiple different cognitive function parameters.
Well, so here's my big question. Bulletproof coffee is a marketing, in my opinion, is a marketing tool, because coffee is coffee. It's not, so this type of coffee, bulletproof coffee, is not a special coffee, correct? There's nothing different about the coffee. It's coffee, correct?
Well, it's coffee with butter and
No. It's just coffee, right?
The coffee itself?
Yeah, it's coffee.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's different.
Like, it's not made in some special unicorn world that makes a different coffee.
No, it might claim to be organic or whatever, but
okay, so it's coffee.
But I'm not even talking about it.
Hold on.
But hold on. You're thinking about it from a brand name standpoint. I'm thinking about it from a fact of somebody sitting at home just putting butter and MCT oil into their coffee and calling it bulletproof, because that's kind of the same concept there.
But concept, it's the same. If you put grass-fed butter and MCT oil in regular coffee, like if I go get a Dunkin' Donuts coffee, black, and I put grass-fed butter and MCT oil in it, that is bulletproof coffee?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So you're hearing, just hear me out. I'm asking questions for our listeners because I just want to make sure that bulletproof coffee, I think people think, and I could be wrong, but I think people think bulletproof coffee is some special unicorn coffee that creates weight loss in a different way than if you go to Dunkin' Donuts and get coffee and put in grass-fed butter and MCT oil on your own, then that's a different type of coffee.
I don't know if that's
what
people,
I'm saying.
I don't know if that's what people think, though, because I had a conversation with a client the other day that asked me. He said, well, isn't putting butter in your coffee, isn't there some type of benefit to it? So I just think overall people think bulletproof coffee or not, whatever it's called, I think people have this notion because it's been marketed, as you're saying, it's been marketed in a certain way where people think, oh, well, there's got to be some benefits of putting butter in your coffee because people do it and I've heard about it. But I don't really know where it came from, which I'm telling you where it came from, but it's not, it's just butter and MCT oil in your coffee.
Right. And so the bulletproof part is that it's bulletproof, that it creates this cognitive clarity, and which regular coffee does as well. Like, I mean, the coffee part is where I think we could talk about caffeine forever or coffee forever, but the benefits of it are that it helps with fat loss, correct?
No, that's not the benefit.
So then what is the, what
the
is
proposed
the
benefits or what, well, we talked about here is that it boosts mental focus, decreases hunger, and maintains steady energy throughout the day, supposedly.
Which, okay. So that's what the claim is for bulletproof coffee?
Those are the claims. Those are the major claims on bulletproof coffee.
Okay. And so is that because of the type of fat that is used with the caffeine or the coffee?
I mean, I don't know what it's because of, because it's not really doing any of that stuff, right? So that's, even if you're looking at it from a standpoint of satiety, right? Consuming one bulletproof coffee containing 250 calories as compared to black coffee does not appear to increase feelings of fullness and result in a reduction in perceived prospective food consumption after 3 hours. So essentially what that's saying is whether or not you have butter in your coffee, like if you have butter in your coffee or you don't have butter in your coffee, how hungry are you going to be 3 hours later? And it's going to be exactly the same. So this notion that you're fuller by just putting butter and MCT oil into your coffee is just kind of ridiculous to me. And I would even go as far as to say that butter is unique in terms of LDL cholesterol, in that it is more likely to raise LDL cholesterol than some other sources of saturated fat. Remember, butter is an animal fat. It's high in saturated fat. Mm-hmm. Butter seems to particularly be troublesome for LDL cholesterol in some people, maybe not all, in that it can have a huge impact on LDL cholesterol, which is an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease. I would never recommend from a health standpoint that somebody, you are not going to be bulletproof by putting butter and MCT oil into your coffee. Now, what I'll say from an MCT oil standpoint is MCT oil, when someone is doing a ketogenic diet, MCT oil and caprylic acid is essentially an MCT oil that's found in, it's like isolated from coconut oil. Mm-hmm. And that's unique in that it's a medium chain triglyceride and it goes right into, it bypasses lymph, right? So when you consume any other fat, it typically will have to go through your lymphatic system, but MCT oil will bypass the lymphatic system, go right into the circulatory system, and it will be used right away for energy. So I think this is where some of the thought may be, where it's well, MCT oil may increase mental clarity, but it actually doesn't. But what I will say is when somebody's doing a ketogenic diet, there is some information on these specific types of fatty acids that they may increase ketogenesis. So you may create more ketone bodies by consuming these certain types of fat. But does that say that there's any added health benefit or performance benefit? Absolutely not. It may just push you into ketosis a little bit further if you're having a very low carbohydrate, high fat diet. But there's nothing special about putting these components into your coffee, I guess, is really the message that I want to put out here.
Yeah. So you're saying it's overrated because, go ahead.
It doesn't do what it says it's going
to
do.
Well, no, but you're saying in context to the ketogenic diet, these are the claims with this specific type of fat that they're coupling the coffee with. That's what makes this quote unquote bulletproof in their marketing.
I mean, I guess it's supposed to be like if you're in a ketogenic diet, because Dave Asprey's a keto guy, right? So yeah. he's the bulletproof diet is a keto diet. So
right.
I guess it's adding MCT oil in there may push you further into ketosis, but the actual effects of it are not going to be what it's kind of perceived to be.
Yeah.
And I think people just do it and they think, oh, well, this is healthy for me. This and they really have no idea about even any of those claims. Like my client, for example, that I had a conversation with, and he was like, well, isn't that healthy in some way, shape, or form? But he had no idea how.
Right, right.
People think there's this magical thing about like, oh, well, what about the delivery of caffeine because you're consuming it with butter and, you know, whatever.
Oh,
and I'm
on.
Like, well, you're probably, if anything, because you're consuming the caffeine with something that's going to potentially slightly delay gastric emptying, you're probably getting a slower delivery or less of a delivery of the caffeine in and of itself. And also, I would kind of add here that from a coffee standpoint, this is kind of looked at as something that you should do in the morning prior to breakfast. And from a caffeine standpoint, I think that it's less optimal to have caffeine in the morning because you wake up in the morning, you're supposed to rely on your cortisol to keep you alert. And probably not until like 10 or 11 o'clock should you have your first cup of coffee if we're talking about ideal scenarios here.
Mm-hmm.
You want to move on to the next one, Nicole?
Number three. The ketogenic diet.
Speaking of the ketogenic
Speaking
diet.
Speaking of.
So, ketogenic diet was initially, and I don't think people really understand the history of the ketogenic diet and where it came from. This is something that we've talked about on a previous episode where we did a whole episode a very long time ago on the keto diet. Keto diet actually started with Hippocrates, where he used to see children who suffered from epilepsy. They used to have seizures. And with the seizure disorder, what it would happen is they would stop eating for a period of time because they were just constantly having seizures. So they just couldn't physically eat. And what would happen is the seizures would subside. So they tried to see, okay, well, what's going on with these kids that they're no longer having these epileptic seizures? And what was happening was that they were actually fasting. And what they found was that, well, fasting created this scenario where the body produces ketones and the brain uses ketones, and then you have less of an incidence of seizures. But you can't just fast and have these kids starve for eternity. So they kind of thought of a way like, okay, how are we going to reproduce this environment without and have these kids still eat? And then that's where keto came in, because they found that consuming a ketogenic diet, high fat, very low carbohydrate. And in epileptic kids, the carb recommendation, like the diets that we use now from a clinical standpoint for seizure disorders, are very, very like lower than what people think is the conventional, like under 50 grams is what people generally say. Oh, well, if you're under 50 grams, you can be in keto. For these kids, it's under 5 grams of carbohydrate, which is very, very difficult to stick. There are a lot of restrictions with that diet. But essentially, the point is that they found that if you have this ketogenic diet, then that will mimic the fasting environment and therefore will be supportive to these kids as kind of, you know, we have medications for epilepsy and stuff now. And sometimes people, I don't know, they kind of couple it with their, I've heard some stuff with like CBD and, or I don't know if it's CBD or THC, but there's some benefit there with epileptic seizures as well, with cannabinoids, I guess. But in any case, then we started, I guess you fast forward into, I don't know, Nicole, 70s, 80s, maybe 90s, right? The ketogenic diet kept popping up with, hey, maybe there's potential other benefits for it. And one of the potential benefits is supposedly weight loss and metabolic health. However, when you look at different macronutrient distributions all across the board, what we find is that calorie deficits are what does it. So regardless if you're eating, and this has been supported by lots and lots of studies over a long period of time, is that if you're having high carb, low fat, low carb, high fat, moderate, whatever it is, you're going to have the same outcomes as long as you're in the same deficit, right? So if you take three different dietary patterns, three different macronutrient distributions, and you have a 25% calorie deficit in each of these mm-hmm. groups, they're going to yield about the same weight loss. And actually, there's a slight difference in the low-fat diet that you have a tiny bit more, not really significantly more, so it really doesn't matter, but you have a tiny bit more fat loss in the low-fat group rather than the high-fat group. And that kind of makes sense because when you think about what gets stored as fat, like fat is already fat and can easily be stored. Carbs have to actually convert into fat in order to be stored. So that makes sense from that standpoint. And the other thing I'll bring up, Nicole, is cancer. And people are starting to now, I think this is more of a newer kind of viewpoint. I recently did this article. I read this article for school, and it was a pilot study. I actually have it right here in front of me. It was a pilot study, effects of a ketogenic diet on the quality of life in 16 patients with advanced cancer. And essentially what happened was they took 16 patients that had cancer that was kind of untreatable, right? So the criteria for these cancer patients was that they couldn't be eligible for, like they could no longer be eligible for a form of therapy, whether it be chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, any type of intervention that you would use for cancer. Now, they said, okay, well, let's look at the ketogenic diet. And the reason why they want to look at the ketogenic diet is because of something called the Warburg effect. And this is something we talked about with Joe Zundel when we talked mm-hmm. about, is it kind of appropriate to say that, okay, well, because cancer cells increase carbohydrate metabolism or sugar metabolism, then, well, if we starve them of that and we give them fat instead, are we going to have a different outcome, right? Are we going to improve the cancer by starving it? Now, the problem with this is, like we talked with Dr. Joe Zundel about, is it's really going to be dependent on the type of cancer, and it also hasn't been studied a lot. And now this study in particular was looking at quality of life. First and foremost, if I'm at an advanced stage of cancer, I'm not thinking about being on a ketogenic diet. Fuck that. I'm going to eat whatever the fuck I want. Like, I don't understand what the purpose of that for people who are advanced. Like, are you kidding me? I'm eating cookies. I'm eating whatever the hell I want, because nothing that I don't even qualify for other therapies because I'm so far advanced. Right. So in any case, what they found was that it was very difficult to adhere to. The other piece, one of the biggest flaws in this study was that they didn't, first of all, what they had no control group. Right. And this is what kind of boggles my mind with certain research. It's like, just because it's published doesn't mean that it's true. They had no control group. The parameters on quality of life, there were maybe two of them that were positive and the rest were negative. And the positive ones were probably due to a placebo effect. But the author still concluded, like, hey, this can increase quality of life of these patients. And I'm like, well, no, it can't, because A, they couldn't stick to it. All of the parameters that you measured for quality of life are not showing what you're concluding. And C, you started with 16 patients, two of them died, and the rest of them dropped out for various different reasons. And a lot of them dropped out because they couldn't stick to the diet. So you ended up with five patients at the end of the study, and only three of them had consistent markers of ketone bodies in the urinalysis that they were doing. They were peeing on these ketone strips. So out of those five, you exclude two, and now you're left with three people that actually adhered to the diet. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is a ketogenic diet for anybody, from a cancer standpoint, we don't know. I don't think that we're going to find something groundbreaking from a cancer standpoint on the ketogenic diet. I also don't think from a weight loss standpoint that there's anything groundbreaking about it. Is it something that you could potentially use? Yes. What I would say to be careful of if you do want to do a ketogenic diet is, depending on how it's done, it can be either beneficial or detrimental to cardiovascular health, depending on what types of fat you're choosing to eat. So if you're eating a diet high, predominantly high in animal fat and saturated fat, that is not going to be beneficial for you. I also don't think that eating a diet high in coconut oil, which is also a saturated fat, medium chain triglyceride, lauric acid, like we talked about, I don't think that that's going to be beneficial either. People think that coconut oil, I mean, we don't have that on the list today, but I could say coconut oil is overrated too. But overall, depending on the types of fat that you choose, are going to determine whether or not this is going to be a healthy strategy for you. And for all of those reasons, I'm going to say the ketogenic diet is largely overrated.
All right, you ready for number four?
All right, let's get it.
Okay, intermittent fasting.
Another diet strategy here. So again, here's what we're going to go with. There was that study, Nicole, in one of Bill Campbell's recent research reviews. Mm-hmm. So well, let's talk about it from a weight loss standpoint first, where it was 12 weeks of dieting. One group was told to eat between, I believe it was 12 and 4 p.m. So it was a 16-8 fast. And the other group was told to eat all day. The group that fasted, I don't think that they were told to decrease their calories, but by default, they did because they were eating in a smaller window. And what they found over 12 weeks is no significant difference in muscle maintained, no significant difference in body fat lost or total weight lost. And the ratios of fat to muscle lost, because you generally lose about 25% muscle, 75% fat. So like for every pound of fat, you're going to say a quarter of that's going to be muscle, or a pound of weight lost, a quarter of that's going to be muscle. And 75% of that is going to be coming from fat tissue. They saw basically the same thing all across the board over 12 weeks. And what I like about this study that he reviewed was that they used food journals, right? A lot of these studies, they use food frequency questionnaires to say, hey, what were they eating? And then can we calculate how many calories, right? They put it into a software that automatically says how many calories were they eating on any given day. And they also had follow-up phone calls with professionals that were kind of coaching them and guiding them throughout the process. So because they did it with food journals, I think that the dietary recall is more accurate than doing a 24-hour recall where you're just like, I ate this food, this is how much of it I ate. Like, you need to really weigh and measure and really focus on the quantities and the foods that you're eating on a day-to-day basis with a journal in order to have accurate data. And that's what this study did. And from a weight loss standpoint, they didn't see any difference. So weight loss isn't attributed to time restriction. Weight loss is attributed to calorie restriction. And on the other end of that, from intermittent fasting, is metabolic autophagy, which is cell cleanup. It's cells engulfing parts that no longer work, that they no longer need, and using them for energy for other processes. And that is something that happens with intermittent fasting, but it's not unique to fasting. It's a mechanism, again, not unique to time restriction, unique to calorie restriction. So what we find in research on calorie deficits, and if you look at calorie deficit research and then you look separately at intermittent fasting research, and then you measure autophagy, you'll find the same amount of autophagy as long as you are restricting the calories in the same quantity, right? So if you have a 25% reduction, and this also kind of speaks to all of the things that we talk about, right? Like cellular senescence, right? We talk about there are so many processes that happen from an aging standpoint, right? Aging research talks about, for example, stimulation of mTOR, right? And Nicole, we know about mTOR because mTOR is the gene that codes for muscle protein synthesis. So for example, if you have a high amount of leucine in the diet, or you eat protein, or you do resistance training, you have that stimulus, you are expressing mTOR, which codes for muscle protein synthesis. So you build things, right? And it's interesting because that's a lot of the stuff that we talk about, and mTOR as like a good thing, but from an aging standpoint, mTOR is actually kind of seen as a negative thing, where it's like, well, stimulating that is, it also increases aging, right? So this is where we get the kind of notion that, well, intermittent fasting, because you're fasting, must be good for aging and longevity. And what I'll say is this, we know that from animal models, and we can't really replicate this in humans because it's unethical. But if we put animals in large caloric restriction for prolonged periods of time, they not only live longer, but they look younger as they age. So yes, we do know that creating those kinds of deficits, but key word there, I'm creating a deficit. They don't necessarily have to fast in order to increase longevity. And this is where the big miss is. You don't have to fast to lose weight. You just have to create a calorie deficit. And what you're doing, why people attribute their weight loss success to intermittent fasting is because that may have been something that allowed them to stick to it. Hey, I just don't eat at this time and I don't have to focus on what I'm eating or how much I'm eating in the small window that I'm giving myself. And that has allowed them to create a calorie deficit, and they attribute the success to intermittent fasting. However, the success is really attributed to the fact that that intermittent fasting strategy was able to create a calorie deficit. And then, like I said, from an aging standpoint, I just think that it's healthy to have some level of caloric restriction from all different parameters, from cardiovascular disease, from type 2 diabetes, right? All of these different things, all of these diseases are brought up by overeating. So what's the solution to healthy aging and living a disease-free life, or trying to live a disease-free life? There's no guarantees, right? The solution is every once in a while to be in a calorie deficit and not be in this overfed state.
Yeah, I think the biggest piece is not to overstress the body with too many calories. That is the bottom line. If you are someone that is chronically overeating, you're in trouble. If you're chronically overeating and your body is stressed because of that amount of calories, then you're going to be in trouble from a health standpoint, from an age standpoint. I mean, we're all going to die. Like, we're all, this is not something you can prevent. But if you want to live the best quality life that you can, I think that you have to just understand what moderation is. Like, too much, too little of anything is not good for the body in terms of stress and balance. So listen, if giving you feeding windows helps from a mindset, mental adherence, more power to you. But we all know that it's not, because 1200 calories in 4 hours the day that you ate versus 1200 calories in 12 hours a day that you ate, is there's no difference from a time standpoint. I get it. I think it's overrated as well. But I mean, if it works for people, it works. Go for it. It has its place.
If you can adhere to it, then it may be something that you may be able to use as a strategy to create a caloric deficit. But the fasting itself and the claims around fasting are overrated. You know what I wish we had? I wish we had like a button that we can push where it's just like overrated, right? Like something like that.
We'll get Kobe and CZ and Zoe to either bark or meow for overrated and meow for underrated or something.
Two meows for overrated, one meow for underrated.
One bark for underrated or something. Get the fur babies involved.
But yes, I mean, I'm going to say intermittent fasting is going to be largely overrated. If you want to use it for creating a calorie deficit and that helps you adhere to your program, like I said, then it's going to be beneficial for you. I think if you want healthy aging, then don't be overweight. Don't overfeed yourself, because that's associated with inflammatory markers and associated with insulin resistance, because you increase body fat. It's also associated with many other metabolic disturbances, just overfeeding over prolonged periods of time. And that's what the typical Western diet is.
Yeah. But a lot of people can't move, like can't walk up and down stairs, can't touch their toes, can't put on their own shoes, can't bend over to pick up laundry baskets. I mean, we need to, like, I think that's part of the reason why, like, when I think of all these diet strategies, I think of things like that, like what's going to get people to live better. If it works, it works. Because we're at a place, honestly, Daron, where people are not living well if they can't walk up and down stairs, bend over and touch their toes, pick up a laundry. I mean, it's bad.
Movement is really getting bad. I think from an aging perspective, it's about how long you're going to live, but also how you're going to live your last years. Right? Yeah. If you don't age well, oof, you're going to suffer when you start approaching those, you know, 80s and 90s, if you even live that long, right? Average life expectancy for a male, I think, in the US is in like the mid 70s.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. But
it's because people don't think about that period in their life. When you're in your 30s, I didn't think about what I was going to be like when I was even 50. And guess what? A couple months, I'm going to be 50. I'm thinking very differently about how I treat my body. And I treat my body really well. I want even more out of the next 20 years.
Well, think about this, Nicole. Think about people in your age group that you know that you grew up with. I saw a post on Instagram today that made me think about that. People look at me and they say, "You're 37? No way. No fucking way." I was 32 and I was 30. But it's a lot of people that I grew up with they don't look like they look 20 years older than me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're not physically active, because they don't take care of the food that they're feeding themselves, all of that stuff. They just look significantly older.
Yeah. I remember a professor of mine when I was in school saying, you have one body and it's your responsibility to take care of it. You can decide to destroy it quickly, or you can decide to take care of it and have it deteriorate slowly. And that has always stuck with me in how I prioritize my health and wellness.
I had a trainer that I worked with that used to say, you're born small and weak, you die small and weak, how you live in between is up to you.
Oh, that's a good one.
That was a really good one.
That's a good one.
All right, let's move on to the next one. All right,
number five.
Let's move on to the next one.
All right, number five is the Mediterranean diet.
Mediterranean diet, I think, is the most underrated diet in the history of diets. And I think it is probably, like, if I had to choose one diet that research continuously supports, it's a Mediterranean diet, which is predominantly plant-based. Lots of plants, lots of antioxidants, lots of phytochemicals. Fish at least twice a week. Olive oil being the predominating fat in the diet, because of the, you know, the polyphenols in there, they're shown to be beneficial. Nuts and seeds and whole grains. And again, like I said, lots of plants and antioxidants, phytochemicals. But there's an interesting piece, especially when we look at, Nicole, what's the number one killer in the U.S.? Like, what do people die from the most?
Heart disease.
Heart disease, right? So when we look at heart disease specifically, the Mediterranean diet seems to really shine in the research amongst people in terms of preventing heart disease, but also in terms of preventing secondary events, which is essentially like you had a heart attack or a stroke already.
Yeah.
And you go on a Mediterranean diet and you're less likely to have repeat events. What we find, which is interesting, is that there's something special about olive oil, because when you have, there's a study that I looked at that compared a Mediterranean diet with predominantly nuts and seeds versus a Mediterranean diet with a lot of, with added olive oil. And what we find is that the added olive oil has some kind of a benefit beyond just a Mediterranean diet in and of itself. So I would say a Mediterranean diet with the addition of olive oil as the predominating fat, I think is wildly underrated. Now, what I'll say is from a heat standpoint, I really like to use avocado oil to cook with because it can withstand more heat. But if you look at like extra virgin olive oil, like on a salad, on your vegetables, things of that sort, that's going to be super beneficial for your overall health, especially if you're concerned with cardiovascular, like maybe you have a family history of heart disease. Then I think a Mediterranean diet with the addition of olive oil is going to be tremendous.
I do believe it's underrated as well. But I also would say, like, I mean, you know me, you know, I'm going to go right in on people that are allergic to fish or nuts, and they can just supplement out different types of proteins and fats. I mean, I feel like you can manipulate them in the Mediterranean diet in a lot of different ways, but the mostly plant-based healthy fats, whole grains. I mean, to me, that's just healthy eating in general.
You know, what's interesting to me, Nicole, is you talked about fish and people being allergic to fish. I mean, you can find plant sources of omega-3 fatty acids, which are which is the predominating fat in a lot of like fattier fish, like a salmon, for example, wild caught, not really farm raised. But if you get it from plants like flax seeds, for example, or chia seeds, you're going to get predominantly ALA, which is alpha-linoleic acid, which is not as bioavailable. It's actually more bioavailable for women than it is for men. Women can convert it into active EPA, DHA, and the substrates that you actually want more readily than men can. But sea algae, if you can do sea algae, it has like a sea algae supplement is going to have omega-3s in the form of EPA, which is what you want. However, what I'll say is supplements too, and I've kind of changed my tune. I don't know if it's really changed my tune. I kind of knew this for a while, but I've read some research recently that suggests where there are a few different studies that will look at, and I forget, there was like the Reduce It trial and there was one other that look at a regular EPA and DHA supplement and risk for heart disease for cardiovascular events. And it shows that it doesn't really have that much benefit. And then the high-dosed EPA supplement, which shows that it has more of a benefit So it's kind of like, oh, well, does fish oil work? It really depends on the context of how you're looking at the research. And the research would suggest that a high dose EPA would work better. And I don't know if it's because the DHA in the fish oil supplement is interfering with the effects of the EPA. Potentially, if you have a much higher dose of EPA, like a higher EPA to DHA ratio, that might be better. But what I will say in regards to fish and fish oil is for anybody who's not really eating fish and is just relying on a fish oil, and again, Nicole, we're not talking about people who are allergic to fish, obviously, they can't eat fish. But if we're talking about if you're not and you're not taking advantage of actually eating fish, research really shows a greater benefit when you're actually eating the fish versus taking a supplement.
Well, of course, eating over a supplement, I think, is always going to be top priority or the first.
Well, the question is why, though, right? So are there other compounds in the fish that are also beneficial to your heart health or your overall health mm-hmm. that you're not getting when you're just extracting the fish oil, which is EPA and DHA?
Yeah, yeah. I'm all about the food.
You know, just raises some food. Questions. I mean, yeah. That's some research that I'd like to that I'm going to follow, obviously, over the next probably forever. But
right. You keep us in the know.
I'll keep you in the loop when something new arises. But that's where we are currently when it comes to fish oil supplementation and fatty acids from fish. Mediterranean diet, underrated. What's
underrated.
Next?
Number six is apple cider vinegar.
Apple cider vinegar. So I'm going to first go over the claims on apple cider vinegar. The claims are gut health, weight loss, and blood glucose control. Gut health, I can't find. There's really nothing. Weight loss, very little. I don't think enough for me to make an impact on what I would say towards, was it going to increase your fat loss? No, it's kind of like I look at certain supplements for weight loss and I say, well, if it does help, for weight loss, if you're going to lose 30, maybe you'll lose like 30 and a quarter pounds, right? So any benefit that it might have on weight loss is kind of going to be minuscule and it's not going to be worth it anyway. However, what I will say from a blood glucose control standpoint, a 2017 meta-analysis shows that vinegar can attenuate postprandial glucose and insulin by delaying gastric emptying and potential inhibition of disaccharide activity in the small intestine. What that means is if you were to take apple cider vinegar together with a meal, that you are going to blunt the blood glucose response. You're essentially, like, let's say you take a high glycemic food, the glycemic index of that food is going to decrease and it's going to have less of an impact on your blood glucose. So there is a benefit in terms of that. But what I will say is it's not a benefit from apple cider vinegar because beneficial effects are due to acetic acid in the vinegar. And if that's the case, I actually looked this up because I was curious the amount of acetic acid in white vinegar versus acetic acid in apple cider vinegar, and white vinegar in some cases have double the amount of acetic acid than apple cider vinegar, which would kind of tell me that white vinegar may actually be better than apple cider vinegar. But overall, it's just about vinegar. It's not necessarily about apple cider vinegar. And because the first two claims, gut health and weight loss, are unsubstantiated, and just the third one is, but it's not specific to apple cider vinegar, I'm still going to say apple cider vinegar is overrated.
I would strongly agree. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Also, vinegar may also be shown to decrease total cholesterol slightly. You know, if you want to have a salad with some vinegar in it, that's perfectly fine. It's going to have some health benefits, but I don't think they're going to be astronomical.
All right. Number seven, branched chain amino acids.
All right. Branched chain amino acids, I'm going to go with... Well, let me break down the thought on branched chain amino acids before I tell you my thoughts on it. And for anyone who follows us on Instagram, you probably already know my thoughts on this. Branched chain amino acids are leucine, valine, and isoleucine, and they're different in, there are three essential amino acids, and they just differ in structure than other amino acids because they have a branched chain, right? So the molecule just kind of looks a little different. Now, branched chain amino acids are touted as muscle builders because those three are beneficial to building muscle, specifically leucine. And leucine has a very big impact on muscle protein synthesis, right? That mTOR that we talked about earlier. So if you're looking to build muscle, well, it would make sense if you have leucine and branched chain amino acids that taking that supplement is going to help you to build muscle. However, there are other amino acids and there are other essential amino acids that somebody may not be getting enough of. So there's actually probably, if you were going to take one or the other, if you were to take an essential amino acid supplement with all of them or take a branched chain amino acid supplement, the essential amino acid supplement would probably be better to take because you're going to need to build compounds with all of those amino acids and maybe have a high concentration of branched chain amino acids within that essential amino acid supplement. However, if you're consuming a large enough amount of protein in your diet and you're not deficient in protein, and when I say deficient, I don't mean like RDA deficient. I mean deficient in terms of like, what is it going to take for you to optimize muscle building? Like, so for example, if you're having, I don't know, anywhere from 80 to 100% of your body weight in grams of protein per day, you're having enough protein and you're getting enough branched chain amino acids, especially if you're getting it from high quality sources of protein. If you're getting it from animal proteins, if you're getting it from dairy sources, eggs are really good. Whey protein is a really good source of protein. So I'm going to say branched chain amino acids are overrated because you don't actually need them as long as you're consuming adequate protein. And that is what I would go to first before ever thinking somebody would need a branched chain amino acid supplement. I would say, okay, well, I'd rather you just supplement with a protein supplement because you're going to get the branched chain amino acids anyway and other essential amino acids.
Number 8, speaking of protein, whey protein.
Okay, so whey protein, I'm kind of torn on this one, whether or not I really want to say if it's overrated or underrated.
Okay.
And well, I think I'll take it from kind of two standpoints. So whey protein has a very high bioavailability, which is what we talked about. It's actually on the top, right? So if you look at milk protein and egg protein, they have the highest score in terms of the way that it's scored on protein digestibility corrected amino acid score. And I think there's two different ways that they look at that now. There's two different ways of measuring that. But when you look at it, it's given a score and milk protein and egg protein are at the top, and they're about the same in terms of bioavailability, the amino acid profile, right? How optimal is that protein that you're getting in? And whey protein happens to be highly bioavailable, very easy to digest for most people, and have an optimal amino acid profile to build muscle. So if you're looking to build muscle, whey protein is a great supplement. It's very high in branched chain amino acids and specifically leucine, like I talked about with the branched chain amino acids. So another case as to why you don't need a branched chain amino acid supplement. I think it's underrated from a standpoint of being a very high quality protein, but I think it's overrated from the standpoint of the way that it's been marketed. And it used to be, well, you've got this anabolic window and you need to consume whey protein within 30 minutes after your workout. That's how the supplement industry kind of pushed it. So from that standpoint, Nicole, I really think that it's overrated from that standpoint, but I don't know, where are you in terms of whether or not it's overrated or underrated?
Well, I think it depends on if you're getting adequate protein. This is what I'll say also about the BCAAs. Like, everyone always says that branched chain amino acids are not useful, blah, 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 if you are getting enough protein. Keyword being if. The same thing with whey protein. Do I need to supplement with whey protein? Is it a must if I'm getting adequate protein in my, you know, food plan or my diet? I think with both of these, it really depends on if the person is actually getting protein in their diet. I use whey protein with myself, with clients, when I'm not getting enough protein in my normal food plan. So I use it as a way to get protein in during the day. If I know I'm having a busy season and things are really crazy, a protein shake is easier for me to drink when I know that I can't stop to have an actual meal. But like I said earlier in this podcast, I would rather food over a protein shake any day of the week and twice on Sunday. But I use it as just what it's called, a supplement. So I think it's underrated in the sense that people need to eat more protein. I've never had a client, maybe one, that is ever eating adequate amount of protein. In all my years of training, no one is ever eating enough protein when they come to us for nutrition. So I think it's underrated in that sense. I can use it as a way to get people to get more protein in. I think it's overrated in the way, like you said, it's marketed. Marketing with even nutrition now and supplements combined, it's really popular. There's a lot of money to be made. So I think, you know, depends on the situation. A branch chain amino acids, as much as people say they're useless and no money and it's so stupid and you don't need it. Listen, if I have someone that really needs to get protein in and it helps them drink water, I don't stray away from it. I give every client the opportunity to get from point A to point B with as much help as I possibly can. And if that's something that's going to help them get to a place where they're eating more protein in the process of us working on their food habits to get more protein in their diet, I'm going to use it. So I really think that you have to navigate that in a way that works best for you or your client.
You know what I'll say is this. The way that I personally use whey protein is going to be, one, I can get a really good flavor of whey protein that is just, I'm like, this is going to be delicious. I'm going to enjoy it. And I'm going to enjoy it right at the moment where I don't feel like eating a piece of chicken or any other source of protein. And it really is, a lot of these flavors are delicious, which if you have been drinking protein since I have been drinking protein, which is a very long time, you'll know that protein powders have come a very long way. The first protein that I ever drank was Designer Whey. I think it's still around. I don't know if they ever even changed the formula. They had to have with the industry today. But I used to gag when I drank it. So they've come a long way in terms of flavors. I think Muscle Milk was the first one that I experienced that I was like, wow, this is a game changer. And then I was just buying the cases of ready-to-drink Muscle Milks because I wasn't gagging anymore. So the flavors have gone a very long way. And I think in even recent years, right, the flavors went a long way in terms of cookies and cream, vanilla, chocolate. But even in recent years, now, I mean, like cereal milk flavors, it's chips Ahoy cookie flavors. Like,
yeah,
it's
mint chocolate chips, cinnamon toast crunch, birthday cake.
So I think a protein shake for me, it's like if I'm in a calorie deficit and I want something delicious that's going to taste like a snack, but not be a snack, then I'm going to have a scoop of protein. And that's what I'm going to use to supplement in. And the other case that I use it, the other way that I use it is not as an everyday thing. I don't need whey protein. I need to hit my protein goal for the day. Yeah. Whether or not I include whey protein to hit that goal is irrelevant. There's not something magical or special about it. Yes, it is a high quality protein, but I can also eat yogurt and that's a high quality protein, right? So it really depends on your dietary strategy and what your preference is. I don't think that whey protein is special. So from that standpoint, it's going to be overrated, but it's underrated. I think just hitting your protein is maybe underrated.
That's my whole point. And if you need it, you know, unless you're someone that's eating the exact same foods every single day, literally for like the rest of your life or in a cut season or whatever, you need variety. I think it's something that you can utilize as an option.
Absolutely.
That's my take.
Let's move on to the next one, Nicole.
All right. Number 10, gummy vitamins.
Are we at 10? Are you sure we're at 10? Yeah, skipping numbers here.
Let me count. 1, 2.
All right. While you're counting, let's go over gummy vitamins. Gummy vitamins, the issue that I find...
Wait, we're on 9.
We're on 9. See? I knew your counting was off. All right. So we're on 9. So gummy vitamins, from a standpoint of... I mean, there are a lot. There's like ashwagandha gummies. There are multivitamin gummies. There are vitamin C gummies. There are all of these different gummy vitamins. But let me kind of speak about it from, like, let's say a multivitamin standpoint. If you look at a multivitamin in pill form versus a gummy vitamin, and gummies are really popular right now. People love them. I get a little snack. I get to chew on 2 of these in the morning and I get my added health benefit. If you look at the dosage of a regular multivitamin versus a gummy, you'll find that gummies have significantly less of the active vitamin ingredients in them. And you'll also find, if you know anything about the quality of the nutrients that you're taking in, most of the gummy vitamins are going to have kind of what I call like the lesser forms, right? So you'll have cyanocobalamin instead of methylcobalamin. Instead of 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, you're going to have just folic acid in a supplement. And there are some people that have a genetic mutation that doesn't allow them to methylate folate. So for those people, and you don't know that you're that person unless you get genetic testing done to see if you have the polymorphism. So with that being said, I think it's a safer bet just to take the methylated vitamins. in that form. And you don't typically find that, or at least I haven't seen that in gummy form, but you also get low doses. Now, I am an advocate, and some people might disagree with me on this, some practitioners, some nutritionists, dietitians, a lot of people might disagree with me on this, that you, they might say you don't need a multivitamin. And I would argue that you do, because if you go into Chronometer, for example, and you log in your food, you'll find that on any given day, you're going to be deficient in certain nutrients. And that might vary. What you're deficient in might vary from day to day because you don't eat the same thing every day. So in order to cover all bases, I like to take a multivitamin. I'll put a disclaimer on that. I don't like to take mega dose multivitamins. Like if a vitamin supplement has 100% of the ingredients in it, I'm fine with that. But if it has well over that, like 5,000% of B12, I think that's unnecessary, right? Like Nicole, I also drink energy drinks sometimes that also have certain B vitamins, B6, B12, right? So I don't want my multivitamin to be so heavily dosed, but I do want my multivitamin to be higher dosed than what's given in these gummies. And I also think, let's be realistic, you want a gummy because it tastes good, because it's basically like a handful of sugar that you're just consuming, right? So not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but obviously make sure that you're accounting for the calories in your gummies when you're taking it in. I just think that they're overrated from a standpoint of, it's very difficult from a manufacturing standpoint to get a lot of certain active ingredients into this little gummy and still have the consistency of the typical gummy that you want.
Yeah. So quality.
Yeah. So that's where we're at on gummy vitamins. What's next?
Okay. This is actually number 10.
All right. The actual number 10. Let's go.
Number 10. Functional mushrooms.
All right. So this is another topic that has exploded, and we did an entire episode on this. And I think some of the research has changed since then. According to the current body of literature, some of them might have their benefits. Now, I think that eating these certain mushrooms, because mushrooms are very high in beta glucans, soluble fiber, very good for the gut, very good for the microbiome, very good. Beta glucans are also shown to be really good for managing cardiovascular risk because it helps to lower cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, things of that sort. So I do think that mushrooms in general, or just incorporating mushrooms as part of a healthy diet, are going to be beneficial. I do know that Lion's Mane has one really good study with only a small sample size of 30 people, but it was really well done. They used the gold standard for measuring cognitive decline, or the dementia scale that they used. It was a really well done study, but again, it's a small sample size. Cordyceps, the research is kind of mixed. I don't really think that they help with athletic performance like people say. And then we've got other things like turkey tail, shiitake. In my eyes, I just don't think the way that they're being marketed, I don't think aligns with the current body of literature on them. I think to be determined, I may be more optimistic on some of them than I am on others. Like, for example, if I saw more studies on lion's mane, I'd like to see that, but I'm not really entirely convinced on cordyceps. So for that reason, because we need more research in that field, I think functional mushrooms, there's nothing wrong with them, but they are overrated.
All right. You ready for number 11?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Probiotics.
All right. So probiotics, we know a couple of things about them. Probiotics are supposed to help to restore your natural, your gut microflora. I don't want to say natural, but your gut microflora, and produce certain outcomes. If you have digestive issues, I know that a lot of functional practitioners might recommend them. I am not one of those functional practitioners. I really go heavy on the research side of things. And what the research shows in terms of probiotics is, if that strain of bacteria doesn't live inside of you already, you may or may not get a benefit from that strain of bacteria. And what it also shows is, if that bacteria doesn't already live inside of you naturally, then that bacteria is going to be transient, and therefore it's not going to live in you for a prolonged period of time. You're going to stop taking the supplement, and it's going to be out of you. So unless you're consistently, continuously taking the supplement, and even like I said, depending on you as an individual, it may or may not have a benefit for you. I think the benefits of probiotics really haven't been shown in the research enough, and for that reason, I'm going to say they're overrated.
All right, number 12, digestive enzymes.
This is Nicole's favorite topic. Nicole, you want to tackle digestive enzymes?
No, you go first, and then I'll give my opinion.
All right, digestive enzymes. I think a lot of people, from my experience, clients that I've worked with, don't know they exist, don't know what they are, don't know how they work. And I'll explain that. Digestive enzymes are amylases, lipases, and proteases. So amylases, for example, I think a lot of people, if they've taken like biology or any anatomy class or something of that sort, you know that like salivary amylase, you start digesting carbohydrates in your mouth, or you start breaking them down in your mouth through these enzymes that are secreted with your saliva. Lipases break down. You also have amylases, you know, through the digestive tract. You have lipases, which together with bile combined will kind of emulsify the fatty acids, and lipases will break down the fatty acids so that you can digest and absorb them. And then you have proteases that break down the proteins that you eat. And some of these things, so these things are produced in your pancreas, your stomach, your small intestine, all throughout, and even in your mouth, all throughout your digestive tract. And there are also certain foods, like for example, pineapple is very high in bromelain, which is considered a protease. It helps you to break down protein. So for example, if you eat pineapple after a meal or somewhere around your meal, that may help with digestion of that meal. If you eat papaya, papaya has an enzyme called papain in it, right? And that's also a natural protease. So these things are found in foods that you eat. And in some cases, what we find is that individuals will have bloating, digestive discomfort. They'll have flatulence, right? They're going to fart a lot. And sometimes to alleviate that, well, maybe you're not producing enough digestive enzymes. And maybe if you supplement with a good quality digestive enzyme, then that's going to help you. And it's also going to help in terms of absorbing things, right? You want to be able to absorb the fuel that you're eating. So I think in some cases, taking a digestive enzyme is going to be warranted. And I think because people don't really know about them, what they do, and that they exist, I think that that is a reason to say that they're underrated.
I think people mix up or get confused with the difference between a probiotic, a prebiotic, and digestive enzymes. That's where I think a lot of people get confused by them. They don't know the difference between the two. Maybe they don't know what each of them, you know, can do depending on the type of symptoms that they're having. So I think that's where the confusion lies. I do have clients that I have on probiotics and I am on digestive enzymes. And then I have clients that I've used both and it hasn't been as successful. So again, with me, it really depends on the person. If anybody follows me on Instagram and sees my stories, I have pineapple every morning before my breakfast or after my breakfast, depends. And I use that as help with digestion. It is definitely something that I've started implementing probably the last like 3 or 4 years because digestive enzymes I took for a long while when I had some stomach issues. And then I stopped taking them because I do think that digestive enzymes also have a diminishing return. Like you can take them for a period of time, but you can't continue to take them forever. And I think you have to kind of wean yourself off or use them for certain periods of time to get your digestive system back on track, but I wouldn't live on them. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but
I don't know if I really have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I that's my opinion. So
okay, I'll take it.
All right, number 13, since we're on the whole probiotic prebiotic, is prebiotics.
All right, so let's kind of run through this, right? So we just talked about digestive enzymes, which are enzymes that are made in your pancreas, made and secreted in your pancreas, your stomach, or your small intestine. Amylase, lipases, proteases, that helps to basically break apart. Like, for example, think about lactase is mm-hmm. a digestive enzyme. And if you're missing it, then you get discomfort in your stomach or digestive discomfort. And the reason why is because it's glucose bound to galactose, and that's what makes lactose. And you're unable to break apart the bond between the glucose and the galactose. So lactase enzyme breaks apart that bond. That is what digestive enzymes do. That's how they function. Probiotics are the bacteria that you're eating, because Nicole, you just said that people don't know the difference between them. So we're going to recap that.
Yep.
Probiotics are actual live cultures of bacteria that you're consuming. You can get that through food too. For example, sauerkraut or yogurt, very high in probiotics. We hear about acidophilus a lot, bifidobacteria, things of that sort. Now, prebiotics are food for the probiotics. They're feeding your microbiome. And typically that prebiotic is, it's in the form of fiber. It's a soluble fiber. Soluble fiber is shown to be really super beneficial, super healthy. Prebiotics is something that I always go to over a probiotic because prebiotics will feed your current microbiome and allow it to flourish and continue to colonize. Mm-hmm. And what happens when your microbiome consumes that prebiotic, that soluble fiber that you're eating, it ferments it into these things called short-chain fatty acids. And these short-chain fatty acids are acetate, propionate, and butyrate. And butyrate provides energy to the intestinal lining, to your colonocytes, right, to your colon, because that's where the bacteria lives. And I think that butyrate is at the center of reduction in colon cancer. And that's why fiber is so tightly associated with your risk of colon cancer. If you eat less fiber, then you mm-hmm. have a higher risk for colon cancer. If you eat more fiber, then you're going to have a lower risk. Obviously, there are other environmental factors that will go into that, but I think that that's a big piece of that. And these short chain fatty acids, what they do is they help increase GLP-1 or 2. It's one of those that helps to increase cellular proliferation, right? So formation of new cells. You have new vibrant cells, you provide energy to the current cells that you have. And butyrate is just really good for overall health. Propionate and acetate go to other places and they're super beneficial. And you don't really get that without your microbiome producing that for you. It's not like you're eating those types of fat in your diet every day. So from that standpoint, I'm going to say that prebiotics are underrated. And the recommendation that I always make is just get in more fiber. You don't have to really measure soluble fiber because you have soluble and unsoluble or insoluble. And insoluble is not really that's not what's feeding your microbiome. It's the soluble fiber, but you don't really need to focus on that. You just really focus more so on just getting your fiber intake up. And by default, you'll be getting a decent amount of that is going to be soluble fiber. Underrated.
Agree. Okay. Number 14 is celery juice.
All right. So this comes from, I think the origin of this really is Anthony Williams, the medical medium. Nicole, correct me if I'm wrong there. I don't know if I heard of it prior to hearing about him.
Well, I've heard about it in lots of different places. Well, no, I haven't just heard about it from him.
I feel like he started the whole thing.
But
I feel like he may be either the inception of that or the perpetuator of it.
I'm not sure. Let me just say that. All I can tell you is that a lot of functional practitioners that I have been in contact with and spoken with pushed celery juice.
Okay. So a couple things I'll say about celery juice. It's not magical. Anthony Williams, who pushes it, I kind of want to go that route because he's known as the medical medium, which kind of insinuates that he talks to spirits and they tell him how to cure people. And the guy's got no medical background. He's got no nutrition background. He's got no science background. He just spews things out. And people like Gwyneth Paltrow and every other celebrity nut job that follows him believe that what he's saying is true. And I think if anybody is telling you to consume something based on what a spirit has told you, I think that person belongs in a mental institution. I really do. Prevention of cancer? No, zero evidence. Lowering cholesterol? Also zero evidence. As a source of insoluble fiber, whole celery may help to decrease overall heart disease risk and promote gut health. However, it's not any different than any other vegetable that you would consume. Controlling blood sugar, yes, a little bit, because it has a higher, like if you ever look at nitrate-free bacon or uncured bacon, you'll notice that they use celery salt because it's nitrates and they're just basically replacing nitrates from, you know, I guess artificial sodium nitrate they're replacing with the nitrates that are in the celery. And that is shown to have some effect on overall blood pressure because it increases vasodilation. So that's one point for celery juice. Preventing digestive disorders, false. It doesn't help with digestion. In fact, I had a client at one point that strongly believed in the medical medium and would tout all about him and talk about him. And one day I had a cold and she was like, drink the celery juice. And I drank the celery juice and it gave me the runs. So I'm going to say it's not good for digestion. celery as an anti-inflammatory, I mean, that's a drastic claim. Yes, are there some antioxidants and potential phytochemicals that may help with that? Yeah, absolutely. But again, not magical and not any different than any other fruit or vegetable that you're eating. Aiding in weight loss, absolutely not. And then promoting clear skin, also not. So I'm going to say it's wildly overrated. And I think it's crazy that anybody would listen to somebody that talks to spirits about their nutrition and health advice.
Wildly. I love the way you use that term.
Wildly. Absolutely.
Oh, well, I think anybody on this podcast, if you've listened, would know that I would also agree. Okay. Number 15, green supplements.
15. We have a lot here. Damn. All right. What do we got? Three more. All right. So green supplements. So the typical green supplement nowadays is going to be, I feel like it used to be something and now it's something else because they're loading it up with more things. So I think it used to be just like fruits and vegetables, and it used to, it would claim like one scoop is equivalent to 10 servings of, greens and reds and whatevers. Now they're mixing more prebiotic fiber into it. There's more probiotics in it. So I think it's overall just a different product these days, but I mean, I'm a Whole Foods guy all the way, so I'm going to say it's overrated. I think, like I said, with probiotics, I think probiotics are overrated. I think the prebiotic fiber you may benefit from, but I'd rather you eat that. And I also think that it's preposterous to think that fruits and vegetables, like 10 servings, is going to be in one tiny little scoop, and that's going to be an equivalent.
Yeah. I know. Listen, I'll go back to my supplementation comment that I made earlier. If it's not 10 servings in one scoop, even if there's two servings and they're getting none, fine, have it. Like I said, I'm trying to get people to just get the basic foundational aspects or fundamental aspects of nutrition in, right? So for Gen Pop, if this is something that helps you while you're working on your behaviors to get more fruits and vegetables in, and we supplement with this as we get better at building your meal plan or your food plan, I'm all for it.
All right. So let me say this. Let me kind of argue this devil's advocate to that, Nicole.
Go for it.
We largely work with a lot of weight loss clients, correct?
Yes.
So would a client benefit more from eating their produce or from supplementing with it from
obviously
a weight loss standpoint?
Eating. Right.
Because
you know me.
You want more volume for less calories when you're in a calorie deficit so that you're not hungry all the time. So eating those fruits and vegetables are going to give you that volume that you need.
100%. But I also am a realistic coach. And I know that there are women in my caseload with 4 children and their busy schedules. And I can either sit and argue with them over getting in their spinach in their omelet in the morning, or I can say, okay, get your life greens in.
What are you trying to say? I'm not a realistic coach here.
No, I'm just saying in general, I just think you have to listen. Let me finish. As a coach, I have tools in my toolbox. The number one case is to get them to eat their fruits and vegetables. I 100% agree. I am 100% with you. But I also am realistic in the fact that until I can get them to that point, I'm going to use whatever I can to get as much good in as possible, because small wins in weight loss at the beginning while they're working on those behaviors for me is going to get them more motivated to want to do it. That's just
I'm going to say it's not something in the arsenal of things that I ever recommend to people. And I just kind of leave it at that.
Okay. Number 16 is sleep.
Are you sure we're on 16 now?
Yeah.
I'm going to just straight up say, I think sleep is the single most underrated thing probably that exists. Anyone trying to be healthy and not die early should be worried about sleep. Sleep deprivation is associated with various genes being expressed for all types of cancer, for type 2 diabetes, for cardiovascular disease. It puts you at more risk for a lot of different things. It puts you at more risk for weight gain. It puts you at a risk of lack of weight loss if that's your goal. It is probably one of the most important aspects of health, if it's not the single most important aspect of health. If you are not getting at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night, you should be concerned about that. You should absolutely be concerned about that. And there are some outliers, high functioning people who sleep less hours than than that, and they're perfectly fine. However, I think more people, and I've said this before, I think more people think that they are those exceptions than there are actually those exceptions that exist. So with that being said, I think that sleep is really underrated. If you want to perform better, if you just want to, you know, your brain, dementia, cognitive issues, right? You need to sleep.
Yes, we agree 100% on that.
Yeah, the most important thing. If you're not sleeping enough, sleep. And listen to two episodes ago. What was that? 134.
Yeah.
Where we talk to a sleep physician and we talk all about different sleep disorders, what goes on when you sleep, all of that fun stuff.
All right. Last one, hydration. So water.
All right. So
I mean, I think this is self-explanatory.
I guess. Yeah. But I don't know if it's necessarily like I've heard people say you shouldn't drink other things. Now, I think overall, as a blanket statement, we should be hydrated regardless of what we're drinking, whether we're drinking tea or let's say we drink diet soda or we drink something with flavor in it or we drink seltzer. I think we need to generally, most people need to increase their consumption of fluids. I am starting to think that people, especially active individuals, need to start increasing their consumption of electrolytes too, so that they can really put that water where it needs to go, and that's into the cell. I think if you suffer from cramps, I think hydration, like for example, if you get a Charlie horse or something of that sort, I think hydration is a go-to, but I also think electrolytes are part of that equation.
Absolutely.
For example, magnesium is very important for muscle relaxation. So if your muscle locks up on you, like it does when you get a Charlie horse or you get a muscle cramp, magnesium may be something that you might be deficient in, which I do think also a lot of people are deficient in. From a digestive standpoint, I think it's really important for healthy digestion. I think hydration of your cells from a performance standpoint, like we're talking about here, what the research shows is that a 2% reduction in hydration status leads to as high as a 10% reduction in athletic performance for athletes. So water is really important and being hydrated is important. For metabolism, I mean, if you think about it, all of these chemical reactions that are occurring in the human body are occurring in a fluid-based medium, which means that if you are not properly hydrated, then metabolic processes are not happening as efficiently as they should or could. Research on weight loss and whether or not water or drinking more water helps with weight loss is yes and no. I've seen different kind of takes on this. So I don't know whether it directly actually helps with weight loss. But what I will say is this, it does help with managing hunger, which indirectly helps with weight loss. Because if you drink a glass of water before your meal, you're going to be more satiated. You're going to be able to adhere to your program. So water is obviously, it's a given that it's underrated, but I think we wanted to just put it in here to really emphasize the importance of proper hydration.
Agree.
And that is our overrated, underrated. Nicole, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I think we smashed, that was 17? That's a lot.
I don't know what number it was. You were keeping track. It's probably wrong.
It's probably wrong. But listen, for any of my clients that are listening that know that I can't count past 5, 6, 7, 8... Then.
Which is why all of Nicole's programs are max 8 reps. All right. So with that being said, that is our overrated, underrated on some topics that I feel like are very popular and people may have some misconceptions or misguidance around. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed this episode, click subscribe, give us 5 stars, write a review, share this with a friend, and you'll hear us next week.